Thank you for downloading The Life Scientific from BBC Radio 4.
When Professor Robin Murray first became a psychiatrist, paranoid thoughts, hearing voices and hallucinations were regarded as the first signs of inevitable mental decline. People experiencing these symptoms were labelled as schizophrenic and were shut away in asylums. Since then, attitudes have changed and treatments improved. Many people with schizophrenia or psychosis can lead normal lives. But despite decades of research, we still don't understand what causes this often distressing and sometimes debilitating mental health problem. 15 years ago, Robin Murray was convinced it was a brain disease. Now he says the evidence is less clear. We know, for instance, that living in a city significantly increases your risk. The bigger the city, the greater the increase. And migrants are 6 times more likely to have schizophrenia than long-term residents of any town, suggesting that the problem is as much social as biological. So, Robin Murray, is it fair to say that over the course of your career studying schizophrenia, you've changed your mind?
Oh, certainly more than once. It's actually much more exciting. If you do a study and you expect to find something, well, it's nice if your pet theory is confirmed, but it's probably more productive if it isn't confirmed. As a scientist, you have to have a balance between having an idea and testing it and then sticking to it if you have the evidence. But you also have to realise that sometimes your ideas are wrong. And one of the interesting things for a psychiatrist is to think, what is the difference between having a delusion and having a scientific idea which nobody else believes in?
Well, this is something we want to uncover during the next half hour. Robin Murray, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you.
Now, you specialised fairly early on in your career in the study of schizophrenia. What was your first direct experience of people with the condition?
Towards the end of my medical school years, I got the chance to go and live in an asylum in a big mental hospital. And my reasons for going there were partly economic, because we got free board and lodgings. Anybody in a mental hospital, and many people were there chronically, once a year they had to have a physical exam. So we would go and do the physical exams, and in return for that we got fed and watered, actually extremely well. We got looked after very well.
Still, it doesn't sound like most people's first choice of halls of residence as a student.
No, it's true. And actually, when I look back on it, my bedroom door didn't have a lock on it. And I was just as prejudiced and frightened about psychotic patients as anybody else. So I wedged a table and a chair against the door just in case some mad person would come in the night. So it just shows you that even somebody who was very fascinated by psychosis shared some of the fears of the general public.
Now, the classic symptoms of schizophrenia or psychosis are hearing voices, hallucinations, delusions. Some have suggested it should be called saliency syndrome because the brain's ability to distinguish what's significant and important from what's not is compromised. Peter Chadwick has been a sufferer for most of his adult life. Here's how he describes living with the condition.
Well, the interesting thing about psychosis when you're actually psychotic is that everything is so meaningful, everything is impregnated with meaning. When you get the idea that there's some persecutory organisation, say the CIA or MI5 or something like that, as happens in paranoid delusions, and you think that they can infiltrate your life right down to the minutiae and maybe even influence your partner or your family and the things that are happening in your very home and on the radio and on television, then nothing is immune from their possible interference. So that everything that happens around you becomes potentially a sign that the persecutory organisation is trying to influence you or trying to communicate with you or trying to mock you. And as you move through the day, you know, you're just jogged like a ball in a pinball machine from one psychologically significant event to the next. And it really is absolute torment, complete torment.
That's a very good description of what it's like to be acutely psychotic. When you're psychotic, you don't have the ability to filter out stimuli. So everything seems important. Why are there all these red cars? Why are these people wearing red jumpers? Could it be that somebody has hired them to follow me? These things seem very significant. So just like the way in which we would have an intense experience if we were watching television and our lottery number came up. People are having these experiences all the time because their dopamine level is too high.
What does dopamine do to the brain?
One of the things that dopamine is involved in is grabbing attention. So it makes you attend to things. So normally this only happens when something is significant. But if you are running on too much dopamine, then you're thinking everything is significant. And then you think, why on earth are all these significant things happening to me? Could it be that I'm very important and therefore I'm enormous? I've been chosen by God for some particular mission. Or alternatively, could it be that all these things are happening to me because they're against me and they're all out to get me? So you can have either grandiose delusions or you can have paranoid delusions in response to this experience of everything being excessively important, excessively salient.
And did you hear stories like this when you were in the psychiatric ward in Glasgow?
Yes, but of course we didn't understand how they came about. At that time, psychiatrists were taught that you had to define madness, but also there was a famous psychiatrist called Jaspers who said that psychotic patients were not understandable. So it was a bit like veterinary medicine, that you diagnose somebody as schizophrenia and then the treatment for that was medication. We were not encouraged at that time.
This is back in the 70s.
Yes, to say, what do the voices talk about? Now we know, for example, that voices are a misinterpretation of inner thought. So the voices reflect what people are concerned about. In these days, you were just taught, find out what kind of voices they are and whether it's schizophrenia or not. So there was no psychological approach to what people were concerned about and what their voices were saying.
And was that part of your motivation for wanting to specialise in schizophrenia?
Yes, I think, anxiety and depression, obsessionality, these are all very interesting, but they're not at the basis of our thinking. But all of us, we rely on our senses. When we hear something, when we see something, when we think something, generally speaking, we accept that these are rational. That if we see something, it's really there. If we hear something, it's really there. But to meet people for whom these fundamentals have gone, how to live one's life if one can't rely on what one hears or one sees, or as we just heard from Peter Chadwick, that the whole day is plagued not by real events, but by imaginary people commenting on one's life to the extent that that becomes more important than the real experience outside. So this, of course, was very fascinating. If we could only understand how this happened, maybe we'd understand more about our own thinking.
Well, in 1972, you moved to the Maudsley Hospital in South London, and you weren't particularly impressed with the status of the field of psychiatry at the time.
No, any able person going into psychiatry had to endure their dean and their professors of medicine saying, why are you going to waste your time? You could be a perfectly good physician. But some bits of medicine are very boring. I mean, what does the heart do? The heart just is a pump. It pumps around the blood, and you can get a machine to substitute for it. You can get an artificial kidney. You can't get an artificial brain. So the essence of us is our brain. At the end of the day, in extreme circumstances, you can have a substitute heart or a substitute kidney, but you can't have a substitute brain because the brain is oneself. The human brain is so complex and so intricate. It's so much more interesting.
You chose to specialise in schizophrenia. How much was known about the condition back in the early 70s?
Well, there was a huge dispute. And there were the analysts, whom the most famous was Ronnie Lang, R.D. Lang, who I was interested in, of course, because he came from Glasgow.
The famous author of The Divided Self.
Yes. So people like that thought everything in schizophrenia was consequent upon social factors, and in particular upon the way one was brought up. So one met a lot of families who were distraught, not only because the son or daughter had schizophrenia, but the parents were blamed by psychiatrists or social workers for having caused it, which was outrageous. So these ideas suggested that psychosis was wholly a social.
And for instance, the idea that the mother is responsible.
Yes, sometimes called the schizophrenogenic mother or the refrigerator mother. So there were these theories without much evidence, and then there were, on the other hand, biologists who said it's all neurochemical or it's all genetic, and there was very little conversation between these two groups. They hated each other and they thought the others were charlatans. So you were in the middle of this great dispute.
Where did you stand at that time?
Well, I prevaricated a bit actually. I tended to, I had started on from a psychological and social point of view, but the scientists essentially were on the brain side. The psychotherapists and analysts at that time, which is different now, they didn't really do research. What Freud said was gospel, and they tended to follow that. So I was much more interested in studying the brain and hoping that we would be able to understand psychosis from studying the brain.
You've decided to come at psychiatry from a proper scientific perspective, and for that you need to carry out scientific research.
Yes.
How did you go about deciding what to investigate? Picking the right scientific question, of course, is, we know, so vitally important.
Well, of course, I was quite junior, and to do any research, you have to have funding. But I was offered a job to look at a chemical called dimethyltryptamine. And this was the days, of course, when in the 60s and 70s, hallucinogens were very fashionable, LSD and so on. And there was a hallucinogen called dimethyltryptamine, which South American Indians used in their mystical ceremonies to produce hallucinations and visions. And it had been suggested that people with schizophrenia might be walking hallucinogenic factories. So they might be producing stuff like dimethyltryptamine. So I spent 18 months with large plastic cans collecting the urine of people with schizophrenia. And indeed, we convinced ourselves that there were differences between people with schizophrenia and the general population.
You gave it away, rather, there, saying we convinced ourselves that it was significant, suggesting that you didn't quite find what you were hoping to find.
No, and I heard this wonderful, very brilliant neurochemist called Seymour Ketty talking about investigating the brain. And he said, collecting the urine of people with schizophrenia and trying to understand what is going on in their brains is like examining the contents of the sewers of the Kremlin and trying to work out what the Soviet Communist Politburo are thinking at the time. When I heard this, I realised how daft it was. The urine is so far away from the brain. Of course, that has been the difficulty in psychiatry. Cardiologists can study the heart. Kidney physicians can do a biopsy of the kidney. But how can you get at the brain to see how it misfunctions? This took a long time before we were able to do this.
Well, in 1987, you wrote a key paper that challenged the prevailing orthodoxy about schizophrenia. Tell us what you discovered.
Yes, well, at that time, schizophrenia, of course, it was thought this was a bit like Alzheimer's disease. It wasn't as severe as Alzheimer's disease, occurring to a person with a normal brain in early adult life and deteriorating thereafter. And what we discovered was that people who had schizophrenia were more likely to have had obstetric events, they were more likely to have had things like childhood meningitis and various hazards to their brain in development, and also had never quite done as well as their brothers and sisters. So what we said was that not that schizophrenia is a deterioration, but rather that people, at least a proportion of people, have something go wrong, some subtle developmental abnormality with the brain which makes them vulnerable to psychotic episodes.
So because up until that point, people had seen schizophrenia, as you say, rather like Alzheimer's, that there was this inevitable decline in the patient and it wasn't something that could be halted or reversed or treated.
That's true. And very sadly, some psychiatrists still believe this. 2 weeks ago, I talked to a lady who said that her brother, now in his 30s, when he was diagnosed with having schizophrenia, the family were told, and he was told, you should forget about working, forget about a career. It will be downhill and we will try and minimise your deterioration. Terrible, taking away hope. So by having a developmental approach rather than a deterioration approach, the idea was formed that you could take these individuals and somehow stop them from going on to develop full-blown psychosis.
Now, in 1987... you were very interested in studying children who had developed schizophrenia, but the focus has shifted since then, hasn't it?
Well, there's still lots of studies on early developmental antecedents of schizophrenia, but we ourselves have become more interested in social factors. And one of the factors that influenced us in this was that here we were in South London, and we find that 70% of the people with schizophrenia are not native white English people, particularly people from the Caribbean and from Africa. And so we began to try and work out why is it that there seems to be an increased risk in migrants. If you're a migrant and you're living in a society which is not your own society of origin or that of your parents, then you have an increased risk of schizophrenia. It may be increased by six or more times. First, we thought this might be a misdiagnosis. Maybe it was that British psychiatrists just were unfamiliar with the beliefs of people from Africa or the Caribbean, and they were misdiagnosing people who thought they had been bewitched or subject to the Obi Man. They were misdiagnosing them as schizophrenic. But we got psychiatrists from the Caribbean to come and see our patients, and they also said these people are schizophrenic. So there was something about being a migrant, there was something about coming over to the UK that pushes up the risk.
So it's nothing to do with genes, it's
no, I think,
social.
Oh, we know this because we looked at the risk in their brothers and sisters, and the risk in the brothers and sisters in the Caribbean was something like 4%, and the risk in the brothers and sisters in Britain was something like 25%. So
goodness,
there was some environmental factor. We searched around for physical factors, but we didn't find any. And then we began to look at social factors, and could it be anything to do with the social position of some migrants?
You seem to have come full circle from dismissing the rather woolly, one might say, psychoanalysis approach to a more biological approach. You've now instead been led towards social factors like migration. How did your colleagues in the profession view the radical shift in focus?
I think they probably thought I was losing my mind. Certainly it was not a welcome idea amongst most biological researchers, in particular those in the United States, who still have a very biological view of schizophrenia. But people who did welcome it were the patients and their relatives. And it makes sense.
Now, another issue I know you feel strongly about is cannabis. Over the last 10 years, I know you've been more and more outspoken about the mental health risks of smoking cannabis.
Yes. Throughout the 1990s, we began seeing patients who had not shown any developmental difficulties of the type that I've talked about. And these were people who were really smart at school. They were sociable. They were captain of the soccer team. They were every parent's ideal child.
They didn't fit your model of those children who would possibly go on to develop psychosis.
No, they didn't. But we were a bit slow to realise what was going on. But parents and brothers and sisters kept saying to us, could it be anything to do with the cannabis that they're smoking? And we, of course, being good liberals, would say, no, cannabis is a very safe drug. The British Medical Association, The Lancet, have published editorials saying it's a safe recreational drug. So much better to be smoking cannabis than drinking alcohol. So this was what everybody believed. But we were wrong. Since about 2002, it's become apparent that smoking cannabis, and certainly the more modern variants of cannabis, increases your risk. There are a number of causal risk factors that add together to push people over the threshold into psychosis. It's clear that drug abuse is one of these.
Well, in 2008, the government's Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, chaired then by psychiatrist David Nutt, concluded that there was a probable weak causal link between cannabis use and psychosis, but did not consider the risk serious enough to change cannabis from a Class C to a Class B drug. The government went ahead anyway, and David Nutt was sacked for criticising the government. But he still insists that the health risks associated with smoking cannabis are low.
They were looking for health evidence, and really the only piece of health evidence that might have been there was this link with schizophrenia. And we said, well, this is, it's an issue, but it's certainly not a major issue, and it's definitely not an issue that you can approach by criminalising young people. And this is not an appropriate way to deal with a drug which, whichever way you look at it, is much, much less harmful than alcohol. If we go back 40 years, we see that the consumption of alcohol in this country has gone up by nearly twice. Over the same time course, we have seen that the use of cannabis has gone up 20 times. That twofold increase in the use of alcohol has doubled death rates from liver disease. That 20-fold increase in cannabis use has had no impact whatsoever on the population incidence or prevalence of either schizophrenia or psychosis.
David Nutt doesn't seem overly concerned about this connection between cannabis and psychosis. How big a problem do you think it is?
Well, my argument with the Council on the Misuse of Drugs in the early 2000s was that they didn't accept this at all. So they have moved, and they now do accept that there is a link. But I think there is still legitimate argument as to the extent of the link. And I think much of that relates to the concentration of the critical ingredient, which is called THC. So all the studies that have really been published, with one exception, have been in old-fashioned cannabis like resin or marijuana wheat. And these would contain about 4 or 5% of THC. But what is being sold on the streets is now skunk or sensimila, which has between 14 and 18% of THC. And I think it's the increased use of the more concentrated cannabis which has made psychiatrists like me begin to get anxious. I'm not saying a couple of puffs at the weekend are going to send you mad. You have to try quite hard. But if you're smoking 4 or 5 joints a day for 5 years, then you certainly do increase your risk of psychosis.
So David Nutt's point about this 20-fold increase in the use of cannabis hasn't had any impact whatsoever on the incidence or prevalence of either schizophrenia or psychosis. You would argue what?
Well, I would argue that he has no basis for that statement. That one of the sad things about our understanding of schizophrenia is that there are very few good studies on how common it is. Our own data from South London is that schizophrenia is twice as common in the 2000s as it was in 1964. Now, a number of factors, including migration, but also, I think, drug use, are contributing to that.
But what sort of risks are we talking about? How big a risk is it?
Well, our evidence was that if you start smoking cannabis by 15, then 95% of people will be okay. But 5% would have a psychotic reaction. Now, that's not to say that they would go on to severe schizophrenia, but the evidence does seem to be that if you're smoking skunk every day, then the risk goes up probably about sixfold.
And of course, as you say, we have to be clear here. You're not saying smoking cannabis will make you psychotic.
No, of course not.
Rather, it just dramatically increases your chances of developing the condition if you have a predisposition for getting it in
sure.
the first place.
Sure, and very many famous people, Bob Marley most famously, have been heavy cannabis smokers and come to no harm. It is just that this is one of a number of risk factors. You cannot prove things by epidemiology. We know that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer, not just because of the epidemiological studies, but because researchers painted the backs of poor little mice with tobacco tar, and these mice developed tumours. So what we have to do is biological research to show what is the effect of THC on the brain. And so that's what we are now doing.
You're listening to Robin Murray's Life Scientific with me, Jamal Khalili. Robin, for decades, schizophrenia has been seen primarily as a brain disorder. And this can mean that doctors are less likely to engage with an individual's psychotic experiences, seeing them simply as the incoherent ramblings of a troubled mind. But clinical psychologist Rufus May is a passionate advocate of talking therapies and found a member of self-help groups for people who hear voices.
I don't think looking at people's brains really helps us help people who are experiencing psychosis. We can't understand the plot of EastEnders by taking apart the television. What we're talking about when people hear voices is it's related to their history, or if people are paranoid, they've definitely been persecuted in their life. So we really need to understand the whole person, what they've been through, what their parents have been through, to really understand these complex experiences. Voices are telling us about split off emotions, and we can actually teach people how to stand up to their voices and reclaim their emotions. And it takes time. It's not as easy as prescribing a pill, But at the moment, we still see the majority of patients on psychiatric wards pacing the corridors, waiting for the biological approach to work for them. It doesn't really work.
The simplistic notion that it's only a brain disease and the combination of that with bad psychiatry is fairly toxic. And the standard of psychiatry up and down the country and of the mental health services is not that good. And as Rufus says, if you have 20 people coming to your outpatient clinic, it's easier to prescribe a pill than spend half an hour with each. Well, it's impossible to spend half an hour with each of them talking about the psychological factors that are important. But just because something is psychological does not mean that it's necessarily easy to remedy. We could abolish 30% of schizophrenia if nobody lived in towns or in cities. But we can't do that. So rather than see the social and the neuroscience in opposition, I would think that we should use them together.
But isn't it also the case that despite decades of medical research, we still don't have a definitive way of knowing who suffers from psychosis and who doesn't, other than the symptoms that the patients themselves report?
Of course.
And presumably there is something flawed about looking for biological reasons for something that's defined solely in terms of people's thoughts.
I think as we begin to understand more about the biological basis of thinking, then that will become clearer. But I think the difficulty has been that our biological technologies have been so distant from the clinic, but they're now getting closer. And I see that there will be two big ways forward. One is studying the interaction between particular genes and particular environments. And then I think the other way forward is to use the techniques of brain imaging to study to see if that individual is more vulnerable to this particular adversity.
So which do you think will end up being more important, genes or environment?
I refuse to answer that because the great difficulty has been that the geneticists at one point said it's all genetic and the environmentalists said it's all environmental. And that held up progress for such a long time because they thought they had exclusive rights to finding the cause. It would be very dull if there was no disputes, but I think maybe in 5 years' time the disputes will be very different than the disputes are at present.
Robin Murray, thank you very much indeed.
We hope you enjoyed this programme from the Life Scientific. There are hundreds more science programmes in the Radio 4 Science Archive. Find these in the Science Explorer at bbc.co.uk/radio4.